Whenever someone dies, there are at least a couple people at the funeral who say something like, "Oh, I don't feel like I ever knew him at all," or "Her life was a mystery to me." Well, I feel bad for these people because they don't have what I have. They can't do what I can do, which is to know everything about a person just by smelling them. Whenever I come into contact with a new person, I lean in hard and huff on their aura, and that tells me everything there is to know about that person. If I'm on the subway, I'll saunter up to the guy next to me in that sauntering way I have and rest my forehead in the crook of his neck and perform a sustained inhalation, what yogis refer to as a paraka, long and broad. It's akin to freebasing a thundercloud. And just like that, boom, I know everything about that person. I could tell you what apps are on his phone and what he thinks of Korean pop music, how he likes his tofu, how he got a sweet job doing almost nothing all day but posting Yelp reviews of mid-century French philosophers. But it's a curse as well. For it's so easy for me to know a person in this way that I sometimes get mixed up. I'll be in a movie theater, resting my chin on the cushion of the seat in front of me, casually grazing on the aura of a stranger, and I'll suddenly suck up trace amounts of the 8-year-old Vietnamese girl who made the shirt they're wearing, and I get confused. But in a good way. Like when you get a baby high. I mean, really high. Sometimes, if I'm lucky, I'll tap into a wild ancestral bloom of great aunts and grandparents and hot cousins, and I'll just jam out for hours. As you can probably tell, I've been breathing you in this whole time. I'm getting wafts of this sweet, nutty blush flowing from your heart center, and I'm not even sitting that close to you, but you're coming in strong and solid. I can see the kernel of your soul in my mind's eye like a gecko sees its tears. So pure and so clear. I'm standing in the stream of your consciousness wearing nothing but a bath towel, and I'm slurping the blue rays of your soul with my every pore. Pores that slurp? Well, mine can. If you look closely enough, you'll see that each of my pores is like a tiny mouth with wet, trembling lips, and that I'm just deep-throating your essence with all of my might, with every limb, every organ. I'm about to get so drunk on your aura that I might go into a coma, which would be bad for you because if I lose consciousness with your aura still inside me, you'll be stuck there, hanging out in my useless body until the doctors are shrunk down and injected into me. Like that movie from the 60s that seems so silly now. I'm actually starting to black out. It's too late to turn back. I'm David Cross, and you're listening to the sound of me rippling through your dearest thoughts and memories, live, in real time, on The Organist, the official podcast of The Believer.
Hi, I'm Andrew Leland. I'm an editor at The Believer and the slovenly invisible host of this podcast, which is The Organist, brought to you by KCRW and KCRW.com. We just heard from David Cross, the brilliant comedian and actor who listeners will know from Mr. Show and Arrested Development. David Cross's exploration of his special aura-sniffing powers was written by Matthew Derby, the author of the short story collection Super Flat Times, as well as the more recent interactive iPad, iPhone fiction, The Silent History. And as an erratum, last month's opening monologue by Nick Offerman was written by Kevin Moffitt, who also worked with Derby on The Silent History, which you can download in the iTunes store. In addition to David Cross, this episode we'll hear from Devendra Banhart, Sam Lipsight, also the origins of what's commonly known as gay voice, plus a directory of toll-free ogres and several other things. This podcast is only 2 months old. This is episode 2, but The Believer magazine, from which we sprang fully formed, is celebrating this month its 10-year anniversary of continuous publication. Almost 100 issues of The Believer are out there, in bathrooms and bookshelves, month after month after month of essays and interviews and charts and comics and reviews and grave literary discursions. And it's worth briefly mentioning that magazines exist and survive thanks to their subscribers. Newsstand sales are great, but mostly exist to drive subscription sales. So please, if you do like the magazine or this podcast or the sound of my voice, do not hesitate to go ahead and subscribe right now at believermag.com Later in the show, I'll mention a secret code to get a discounted subscription. Because it's the magazine's 10-year anniversary this month, it's probably a good idea to start today's show with a conversation about the birthday song. Everybody knows the birthday song, but strangely, you almost never hear the birthday song in any popular media. You'll rarely hear it in films or when characters are celebrating their birthdays on TV. And the reason for that is that the song is under copyright and subject to licensing fees.
The rights to Happy Birthday to You are owned by the Time Warner Company, and they bring in about $2 million a year from the song.
I'm talking to Andrea Salenzi from the Free Music Archive, which is a curated library of free music based at the excellent freeform radio station WFMU in Jersey City.
The full history of Happy Birthday to You is complicated, but basically around 1893, two Kentucky kindergarten teachers, the esteemed Hill Sisters, came up with a song to greet their students in the morning. That's Good Morning to All. It sounds like...
It sounds more or less identical to Happy Birthday to You.
Because it is. After the Hill Sisters published their song in one of those old-timey school books, somebody started using it as a birthday song. And then 40 years later, which I imagine used to be the amount of time it took for something to go a little viral, it started showing up in popular culture. It was used in the very first singing telegram in 1933. It was used in an Irving Berlin musical. And that's when the kid sister to the Hill Sisters, Jessica Hill, saw an opportunity. She was able to demonstrate, with help from a lawyer, some undeniable similarities between the two songs, and then she took home the copyright for Happy Birthday to You in 1935.
So how did the song get from this youngest Hill sister into Time Warner's portfolio?
Well, she was working with a music publishing company to do all this, and that company eventually became the wholly owned subsidiary of Warner Music. So now when ASCAP collects royalties for the performance of the birthday song, that goes to Time Warner. And that's why it can cost about 10 grand to use the song in your film. And that's also why sometimes you'll be watching a show like Futurama and you'll hear this.
What day is today? It's Nibbler's birthday. What a day for a birthday. Let's all have some cake.
Aside from TV show sitcom birthday parties, though, is this a serious problem that films face, that they can't include the birthday song and so the film is compromised in some way?
The most notable example of this is in the documentary Eyes on the Prize from the 80s. They have a scene in there where Martin Luther King Jr. is being sung to on his birthday. It's his last birthday.
Some folks celebrate Abraham Lincoln, but we're going to celebrate Martin Luther King's Day today. Don't let him out of here. Happy birthday to you.
And because they kept that scene in, the film was literally pulled off the shelves. It wasn't shown on TV or released on DVD for over a decade.
All of this inspired you and the Free Music Archive to put together this contest. Tell me about your contest.
Yeah, well, we saw that there were only two options. You either go to court to challenge the copyright or you find a new song. So we took on the fool's challenge of trying to dethrone the birthday song.
Tell me about some of these songs. Let's hear some of the songs you got.
You know, a lot of them were what you'd expect. Cute kids singing.
Birthday, 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 birthday. What a surprise, what a surprise.
We also got a lot of very charming international submissions.
Congratulations to the sweetheart.
And there were a few in there that I found just incredibly touching. Like this one. Imagine all your friends just around you singing it.
Let the truth be told. You're 50 years old. Let the truth be told. You're 50 years old. You are alive, like it or not. This is your life. Do what you want. Let the truth be told.
These are great. I want to hear more.
Well, actually, a lot of the entries were just really good songs, but would be really difficult to memorize.
Cells are still dividing to replace any cells that you've lost. And you're smart and you're alive and you can take your prescriptions as much as you need them, not more than you need them, not so you OD on them.
I actually think I will consider singing that to the next birthday celebrating person I encounter. That's solid.
That one might be a little tricky to learn, but this is the one that I want to sing to people. I've been calling it the birthday song that America's just not ready for.
I hope you have a powerful birthday. A powerful birthday. I'm gonna come. Ooh, I'm gonna come. Ooh, I'm gonna come. Ooh, I'm gonna come. Ooh, will there be wieners? Are we gonna eat them? I'm gonna eat them.
Yeah, actually, you're right. I think that's gonna be the one I'll be singing. So, who won?
Our winner was Monk Turner, who performed the song with his regular collaborator, Alana Lynn, who goes by the name Fascinoma.
You know, I really enjoy writing music with her, and I think she feels the same. Hopefully she feels the same.
I think I almost killed him a few times.
So she's kind of like the John Lennon, and I'm kind of like the Paul McCartney. I tend to do more, like, very pop-friendly stuff.
He's got a great, upbeat, high-energy personality. I'm prone to melancholy, so then I think the combination ends up being better than the two different things just on their own.
When they sat down to write the song, they realized that they needed to come up with some kind of guidelines for themselves. First of all, length.
I actually went and timed the original Happy Birthday, depending on the singers, between about 30 seconds and 45 seconds.
Then they needed a memorable melody.
A melody that would be very easy for people to sing and sing out of tune.
And one more thing.
We wanted the music that was going to be backing it up to be kind of cool.
Yeah, so let's hear it now. This is the winning entry selected by the Free Music Archive and their panel of judges. This is It's Your Birthday by Monk Turner and Fascinoma.
It's your birthday. Happy birthday. It's your birthday.
I mean, that's undeniably a catchy tune. It kind of makes me want to buy a whole bunch of tablet computers immediately. They hit the criteria. I could hear a room full of people singing it. I already have memorized it, having heard it only once. But there's no place for us to put your name. I mean, that's the most important part of the birthday song, right?
Oh, yeah. How important is inserting the name? I don't know.
The most important part, as far as I'm concerned, you know, because that's the part that you really, it's the climax of the song. Happy birthday, dear Salenzi, you know, and everybody.
Huh.
Yeah. And so I have to ask, are you confident that you can do this, that you can topple the 1833 classic with this new tune?
Of course not. That was not the point of the contest. I mean, it's obviously to start a conversation. Like, it gets you thinking, right? Like, how important is this one piece of music? Happy Birthday might have been the very first song I ever learned. And I've sung it to everyone I've ever loved. But you have to pay a corporation just to use it. And then you start to think, oh, right, this isn't a rare thing in our culture at all. Like, think of how many times you put Mickey Mouse ears on something. That's Disney's. They could charge you for it. And Apple has a patent on a square with rounded corners. And Cadbury owns like a very special color of purple.
So what point does Happy Birthday to You stop costing $10,000 and become available to people to use again?
People say 2030, but there are also a lot of fearful people who say that the copyright will just get extended and extended and extended. Because when it comes down to these kinds of intellectual property cases, it always ends up being who has the most lawyers. So it's hard to know if Happy Birthday will ever re-enter the public domain. So what do we have? We have this new song. And we're looking for people to use it somehow.
So if you don't have a lot of lawyers, listeners, rather than include the traditional birthday song in your film, I urge you to consider Monk Turner and Fascinoma's It's Your Birthday instead and pay not a dime.
If you can use it somehow, we'll send you the sheet music, we'll send you a CD, and we want to help facilitate this kind of use.
I think it's a noble project. Thanks for telling us about it, Andrea.
My pleasure.
The alternative birthday songs we heard today on the podcast were by E.J. Greenberg, Putzer, Alan Riley, and Fran Agnoni, as well as Romy Stott and Team Steam, and they're all free downloads, Creative Commons friendly, remixable at will at freemusicarchive.org. Our executive producer, Ross Simonini, recently met up for a conversation with the musician and artist Devendra Banhart.
About 10 years ago, Devendra Banhart became known as a folk songwriter with a distinctive ululation. But his music and singing have continued to expand and embrace all sorts of styles and collaborators. He's a passionate music listener and often writes love songs to musical genres such as reggae and 1950s vocal duets. In February, he stopped by my home in New York and we talked about his new paintings, a book of poems he's been working on, and some of the stories behind the songs on his seventh record, Mala, which comes out this month. He also provided a selection of diverse tracks for us to play throughout the episode, including the song you're hearing right now.
I made you a mix CD of different songs that I've been really enjoying. It's just music that I've lately been listening to more than five times a day. I barely, you know, have silence going around. Lately, though, I have been kind of quiet because I'm reading a couple books that I really, really like. One of them is actually by a musician that I grew up, like, idolizing. And then he wrote a novel, Tim Kinsella, from Joan of Arc. He wrote this novel called The Karaoke Singer's Guide to Self-Defense. It's fabulous. It's really, really great. But I really recommend it. It's great. Anyways, these are songs that I've been listening when I'm not reading Tim's book.
I heard once that you were yourself working on a book. Is that true?
A long time ago. It was a folk tale. I wanted to write a folk tale, you know, like Juan Bobo from Puerto Rico and Dominican Republic. You know, they have the folk heroes. Juan Bobo is John the Idiot. You know, John the Idiot is always getting in trouble and he's sort of the fool. You know, the fool. But I scrapped that, and now I'm just working on a small book of really, really short, poems. So that's something. I'm doing something much shorter now, yeah.
How do you think the poems are different than lyrics, or are they the same?
I would never write a poem from someone else's perspective, but a song I would. You know, I was thinking earlier today, like, it'd be cool to write a dance song from Ivan the Terrible's perspective. That sounds fun. Or what would in the last record we had this, like, what would, if the Shags and New Order got together, you know, what would that sound like? So that's the song at the end of Your Fine Penning Dog. It's this dance song. That was the idea. Like, what would that sound like? With a poem, I'd never do that. I just, you know, come up with something small comes along, or the idea is just reduction, essentializing, right? I take a full notebook. How can I just condense this into one line? I mean, that's the work. But it, for me, it's really the words. You know, I start with the words. That's always the most important thing. The words, and then I make notes around the words. What kind of music I think is going to be interesting. Sometimes there's an instrumental, and then the work is finding the title, because the title is so important when you've got an instrumental. You know, I've always wanted to. Did I tell you this? I've always wanted to write an instrumental called "Jim Carrey Alone." You know, and it'd be doesn't that title itself just is so evocative, and his entire film there, and so I'm very excited to do that, and then typically it's like, for me at least, the process of getting to the right music or the right words is my whole philosophy really is just look in the wrong place for a while start off just looking in the wrong place, because that's intuitive for me. I don't know what the right place is, but I definitely know where the wrong place is. And it's a case-by-case thing. Sometimes the wrong place is just like the library. So go to the library, you know. And that helps, you know, you get to this place where you... where, you know, because the song is never done. You know, it's never done. But at least it's incomplete enough.
Mi amor no tiene esperanza, aunque te esperará. Mi corazón se avanza, un fantasma cuerpo real. Mi amor no tiene venganza.
I tend to write in Spanish when I've been listening to songs in Spanish, when I've been speaking on the phone to a family member, to my mom or my cousins or some aunt, or when I'm in South America, and I'll just switch in and just thinking in Spanish, just because the activities of life are kind of talking to me in Spanish. I mean, that sounds pretentious, but so be it. Go fuck yourself. I also sing on the last record. There's a song in the Pit River dialect, the Pit River Indians. You know, they were this like Native American tribe that you know, people forget there was like so many different tribes, and like what we call Crow and Navajo, that was like 15 or 20 other tribes that got just compounded into that, and that wasn't even what they called themselves. I mean, I know very little about this. You know, I'm dilettante in everything, when it comes to everything. But I was reading, you know, these books, and a lot of it was all the catalyst was Dee Brown's "Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee," a classic. But I read that, and it just kind of really messed me up. But I found this book of the few bits of information that exists about all these tribes that are completely just extinct. And one of them was the Pit River Indians, and there was just these little bits of their language. I mean, 20 words. So I wrote this song using those 20 words, trying to string along a sentence. So that's the song on the last record. But that's really fun. Language is fun, right? Language is fun.
Would you say that you write different kinds of poetry or lyrics in different languages, in Spanish and English?
I thought so, but not anymore. I thought, oh, it's easier to sing about autobiographical stuff in Spanish, but it turns out it isn't, and I don't even sing that much autobiographical stuff, you know? I don't even sing that much expressing. I don't express my pain through art. I don't turn art for catharsis either. And so that's it. My answer is no. My answer is no, really. I don't find it. I don't write differently. But also I thought I did.
We once had a time. Meet me at the Castro.
The settings are all experiential, autobiographic. I've been to the setting, but the characters in the songs aren't me. I've got a song, let's say, for example, on the new record called Daniel, and it's these two men that meet, both singers, at the John Reed Sims Choir, otherwise known as the Gay Men's Choir of San Francisco. And they go on these dates, and they fall in love, and then just whatever happens, they break up, and then one of them sees the other one waiting in line to see Sway to play, and hopes and prays that the line doesn't move, is hoping that the line doesn't move so they can stay in that moment, just seeing them a couple people ahead, kind of reliving that affair. And that's the song. I worked at the Castro Theater. I would go see the Gay Men's Choir sing, and I went to go see Suede, of course, when I worked at the Castro Theater, it was really fun. I actually was the guy who would the organ player was blind, so I would chaperone him to the organ. But I was the popcorn machine guy, and I would see the Gay Men's Choir, and I went to see Suede play. I'm a big fan, still am, of Suede. But of course, I was waiting for the fucking line to hurry up so I could get my tickets and go see the show.
I wish we could stay and waiting in line to see Suede play.
I actually was speaking with someone from Germany today, and they'd said that they had never heard the name Hildegard von Bingen other than just something you grew up hearing about her, because she's this old medieval feminist, a pedagogue and a composer, etc. But she's also now a symbol of health, and so they have the Hildegard von Bingen tea, you know, it's organic, etc. But he hadn't heard her outside of that context, and only in the last 7 months had three bands mentioned her. Apparently, this band, The Trail of Dead, or something, you'll notice, they said that their last record is all inspired by her. I thought that was so strange how that came about. And then I've got a song about Hildegard. I was really inspired by her, and I think that a really nice way to pay tribute to someone is to, or at least not even play tribute, but I think more people should be in to know about her, listen to her music, and kind of celebrate her. I think it'd be really strange if I wrote a song that was like, well, in the, in, you know, when 1770, when is 1492, Hildegard, I'm not going to do a song like that. And I'm also not going to cover one of her choral pieces, right? So I thought I would just make up a story where Hildegard does this. She, in fact, escapes the abbey, the convent, the monastery, and she, because she sees MTV, she sees the DJ Kennedy on MTV, and she goes, my God, this is how I'm gonna get my message across. This is gonna be the most effective way. So she absconds in the night and goes to San Francisco to the, I don't think there is an Uptown Tenderloin, but in the story there is, and she goes to the Uptown Tenderloin San Francisco, where there is a, of course, again, fictional television station, and she becomes a VJ.
Now she's working at the station as a VJ.
And in between spinning Africa Bambaataa, Zulu Nation videos, that's all they play. She also, I suppose, preaches. I don't know. Preaches. Yeah. So that yeah.
Hello, and welcome to Old News Summary with Sam Lipsight. I'm Sam Lipsight. Today, let's feast on this underreported gem from the New York Times, October 5th, 2012. Headline, Debate Praise for Romney as Obama is faulted as flat. Apparently, President Obama, in his first debate with challenger Mitt Romney, shocked everybody by shitting the rhetorical bed. Democrats are up in arms about his poor showing and fear a Republican surge after a Romney performance whose verbal alacrity recalled the force and elegance of his anti-gay bullying style in prep school. This is wild stuff, but it brings up a larger question about the efficacy of debates in choosing a president. Think about it. Who were the debate champions in your high school? Were they visionaries, inspiring leaders, men and women you'd walk through a wall for? Or were they just some cocky bastards who prided themselves on being able to argue any position? And what's that about? Resolved, lead paint is okay for children. Let's just put it this way. There's a big difference between a cowboy and a cowboy poet. I know. Don't ask me why I know. The point is, it's hard to tell where all this is going. Will Obama recover from this debacle? Or will Romney keep playing Pericles to Obama's Benji Compson? We'll just have to wait and see.
Sam Lipsight's new collection of stories, The Fun Parts, is out this month from FSG. Now let's hear from Thomas Rogers, a writer and editor in Berlin, who explored the question of what it is exactly that makes gay men's voices sound gay.
Most of you have probably seen Glee, the Fox hit show about a high school glee club. Now listen closely to this clip of Chris Colfer, who plays Kurt Hummel, a member of the singing troupe.
What does a C-lister do when their tiny star is about to fall off Perez Hilton's radar screen? They cause a scandal so extreme they can no longer be ignored.
Now listening to Kurt's voice, you probably noticed a few things. There's a breathiness to it, he has a high pitch and he sounds like he's speaking out of his nose. He likes to draw out his vowels. But if you want to sum up his voice in one word, he sounds gay. Really, really gay. Now, it's common knowledge that if you want to figure out if somebody is gay, all you need to do is listen to their voice. Think of Tim Gunn, the producer and host of Project Runway.
The history of fashion is fascinating, and it really tells the story of our societies and cultures.
Or Mitch from Modern Family.
My dad has this perception that I was very flamboyant as a kid, which is just, it's nonsense, because I kept the whole gay thing very under wraps.
And most gay boys, including me, spend a lot of time during their teen years endlessly analyzing the way they pronounce words, like gorgeous or capri or breakfast buffet, and wondering, oh God, do I really sound like that? Does everybody know? Here's my friend Sam Biederman, a publicist who lives in Brooklyn, talking about the first time he learned about gay voice.
Oh God, this is not made up, but I had an art teacher. He was like, I guess in third grade, and he was like a bear. I remember overhearing he was joking around with a female teacher. And I was overheard a conversation between two of my classmates. And one of them said, do you think they like each other? And the other one said, this girl said, oh, no. Listen to his voice.
Many of my other friends have told me that their anxieties about their voice diminished once they came out of the closet and realized that, for the most part, nobody cared about their vowel sounds. But they often still have a nagging anxiety, a feeling that their voice gives them away when they don't want it to, or makes them feel less manly than they think they are. Here's Sam again.
You know what? On Thursday, I went on this date with this guy who had total gay voice. I really like him, so I hope he doesn't hear this. Sorry. No, but he had, you know, a total, and even his diction, you know, he kept saying, love her, which actually started to piss me off a little bit. I was like, you don't know her. How could you love her? Anyway, I found myself trying to counter it by sort of being like, yeah, well, you know, I, whatever, man. You know, I tried to play up the masculinity thing, because I guess I sensed an imbalance. He was much better looking than me. He was really cute and had a better job. The one thing I could have on him was that I didn't talk gay.
David Thorpe, a New York filmmaker, has interviewed dozens of gay men about their voices as part of his upcoming documentary, Do I Sound Gay? It'll be released in early 2014, but here's a clip.
Your teenagers, especially your early teenagers, are all about survival. And so I remember changing my voice or trying to sound less gay just to survive high school.
I've been uncomfortable with the way that I've sounded for years, but it's like there's nothing I can do about it.
I wear a fitted hat, baggy jeans, Timberland boots. I dress like a hood dude. And the minute I open my mouth, it's a wrap.
On a scale of 1 to 5, how gay do you think you sound?
Does the scale go any higher?
That last voice is David, the filmmaker.
I first really became self-conscious about sounding gay after college. And I had a series of jobs at which I think I was mocked by somebody at every job that I went to for how I sounded. Sometimes if you sound gay, it's like having a rainbow flag stamped on your forehead. And nobody wants to be reduced to a single aspect of themselves. You want to be seen as a three-dimensional human being. The pop culture heyday of the gay voice was without question the 70s. And when I was growing up, Paul Lynde defined gayness in America. He was a huge star, and he was what gay people were to America, and his voice was his defining characteristic.
Who's generally better looking, a fairy or a pixie?
Looks aren't everything.
I'll go for the fairy.
And he was just one of a big group of gay entertainers who had these kind of stereotypical gay voices. Liberace, Charles Nelson Reilly, Waylon Flowers. I would even throw Jim Nabors in there.
Shazam! Tonight it's my turn to tell the folks about Toast Toasties, the toasted cornflakes.
None of these gay entertainers were out, none of them. So it served as code to other gay men who then kind of defined themselves in terms of those voices. And it also reinforced America's notion that gay people are a certain way and talk a certain way.
Now, we often think we can recognize a gay voice when we hear it. It's more flamboyant, more dramatic, more feminine. But if you get down to it, most of us really have no idea what it actually is or where it comes from. And neither until recently did scientists. But in the last few years, a small group of researchers in the field of sociolinguistics have started to find answers. I spoke with Ron Smythe, an associate professor of psychology and linguistics at the University of Toronto, who explained that a gay-sounding voice is actually a female-sounding voice.
And a very good example would be the S sound, as in Sam. On average, in just about every language we've looked at, women produce that sound with a higher frequency than men, a hissier kind of S. My late colleague Hank Rogers did a big survey of phonetic studies of languages across the world, looking at S's. He also looked at vowel durations. He looked at all sorts of things. And in every case that he found a difference between men and women, this was also the difference between voices that sounded gayer or less gay.
Now, Smythe was also quick to point out that listening to a man's voice is actually a horrible way to tell if he's straight or gay. Studies have shown that people can't reliably match voices to sexual orientations. And just because you sound like a flaming queen doesn't mean you secretly are one. This even applies to Michelle Bachmann's very gay-sounding, but very anti-gay husband, Marcus Bachmann.
Just because someone feels it or thinks it doesn't mean that we're supposed to go down that road.
Smythe also told me that we actually develop most of our speech patterns not as adults, but by mimicking friends and family during our childhood. In other words, men who end up sounding gay may just have grown up imitating women instead of men. Here's Smythe again.
It's important to look at the research of a young student in Austin, Texas. This fellow named Peter Wren, who got men and their mothers to rate the amount of cross-gender behavior they participated in when they were little boys. When they were doing role-playing, did they prefer to put on dresses as opposed to a man's suit? Did they play with makeup and so on? And found that those who recalled doing more cross-gender activity were the ones who, as adults, were the ones who spoke with this more gay accent or a feminine voice.
Of course, this doesn't offer much comfort to those gay men who are plagued by anxiety about their voices. But they have another option, to visit John West, an actor and vocal coach at New York Speech Coaching, who specializes in teaching men how to sound more masculine.
We arranged for him to meet with Sam.
My name is John West. I'm an instructor at New York Speech Coaching. We're here today talking with Sam Biederman about his voice,
about gay voices,
about straight voices, and everything in between.
I do think about it all the time, how my life would be different if I didn't have a gay-sounding voice, if I didn't have gay voice. Part of that is because of my job. You know, there is a stereotype of a couple stereotypes of a publicist, and one of them is me. You know, I mean, it's a gay guy in New York sort of calling you and telling you about a really interesting thing that we're trying over here, and, you know, we'd love you to come and check it out.
A lot of times what gay men will do is go too far in their compensation efforts and become lifeless when they feel like they have to get up in front of a room. They're life of the party at the holiday party, and then they have to give a presentation. I'm going to be straight now, and straight men don't smile, and I'm going to talk like this. And so we look at the third quarter earnings, and that's no good either. Most of the people that I have come in here are really, really, really high. And they'll come in and say, so I'm interested in making my voice more manly because my girlfriend is really having a hard time with this. Or they'll say, you know, I feel like when people see me talking at work, it just undermines my credibility because they just think I'm so flaming. I'm going to take you through a couple of the most general exercises that people can do if they want to explore lowering their speaking voice. And we'll do that with you. Let's start with just understanding what the position of the larynx does to the resonance and to the quality of the chords, okay? And then the sound that will result from what the chords are doing there. So again, if you just yawn,
do you feel that your larynx lowers?
Mm-hmm. Right? And so when Morgan Freeman talks about his speaking voice, he often says he is speaking on the yawn. So if you want to do Morgan Freeman, it's just a matter of, if I try to talk like this, they are birds, but they do not fly. It doesn't come out right. But if I lower my larynx like I'm yawning, they are birds, but they do not fly. They are aquatic animal. There's also the issue of some articulation concerns or things that you'd want to be conscious of as well. Most commonly, of course, if I asked someone on the street to imitate a gay man, they would usually immediately opt for a sibilant S, okay? Or a lisp of some kind. If you want to sound more masculine, one quick thing that you can do, pay attention to your S sounds. When they come after what we call a voiced sound, doors, windows, computers, rugs, versus what commonly people will say, rugs, doors, windows, computers. Oprah does this very well. And not only the S's, but with any voiced versus voice consonant sounds.
Can I just note the implicit irony of using Oprah as an example of, you know, masculine? Everyone, if they want to talk more masculine, should talk like Oprah. Gay icon Oprah.
The thing that I should say as this disclaimer, and what I tell anyone when they come in here, is that if we all sounded the same, if there was this over-homogenization of our speaking voices, then the world would have no color. It's really important, I think, that people indulge in the way that the speaking voice is a manifestation of your personality.
If you feel self-conscious about your voice, there's another less expensive solution than voice therapy, which is to accept the fact that your voice, no matter how gay or straight other people think it sounds, is yours, and to remember that you're part of a long line of men with the same nasal resonance and the same sibilant S's and the same anxieties, many of whom became hugely successful and beloved. And in a way, the fact that scientists don't have all the answers yet about where our gay voices come from has its own appeal. Here's David Thorpe.
I used to see that mystery as a deficit, and I think now I see it as kind of a wonderful sort of cosmos to be explored, and that mystery is actually one of a million mysteries that we live with and that make life sort of magical and not just completely knowable. I got really poetic there.
That story was produced by Jenna Weiss Berman.
When I was probably 12 years old or so, somebody called my house in Toledo. I picked up the phone and the person said, hello. I say, hello. And they say, yes, your phone number spells 866-LOVE. I just wanted you to know that. And I said, oh, well, thank you. And she said, well, no problem. Bye. And that was the extent of the conversation. And I realized she was right. My home phone number happened to spell 866-LOVE. So that was something that stayed with me.
That's Brian McMullen, the art director and an editor of McSweeney's. Brian's been writing and designing charts for The Believer since the magazine's inception. One of the first charts he made was called Toll-Free Ogres and Indirectory. The chart laid out more than 100 toll-free numbers that all contain the word ogre.
You dial 1-866-SH-OGRE, and you get something called Carpet Solutions of Derry, New Hampshire, and they provide residential and commercial upholstery, carpet, and office cleaning services. Or if you dial 1-800-JOE-OGRE, you get something called the Able and Able Education Trust of Ashland, Kansas. And 800-OGRE-LAY is Super 8 Hotel of Sweetwater, Tennessee, and they used to be a Best Western, is what they insisted upon telling me when I called.
For The Believer's 10-year anniversary issue, Brian revisited his chart, updating and expanding it for March-April 2013.
I think I was just sad one day and several years ago, and I thought, well, I think I'd like to start calling numbers and talking to people if they'll talk to me. And I liked that ogre was a four-letter word, and it gave me enough, yeah, there were three digits left over that I could, you know, pick a bunch of three-letter words that went with them. So it seemed like something to try. And I think that the very first one I called, in fact, was Art Ogre. I dialed 1-800-ART-OGRE, 1-866-ART-OGRE, 1-877-ART-OGRE, 1-888-ART-OGRE. All of these are toll-free numbers.
Thank you for calling the Cleveland State University Poetry Center. We are currently unavailable to take your call. Our regular hours are Monday through
Thursday. Something about the phrase Art Ogre connecting to a poetry center at a state university in Cleveland. Something funny about that. It's some kind of unintentional humor there. I think a couple things that have been surprising to me is sometimes you'll dial a number and you will get an immediate pickup that just asks you to dial a different toll-free number. So the only purpose of this, of a certain toll-free number, is to deliver a message that you should now call a different toll-free number. Some of these, a handful of these toll-free numbers, seem to lead right to people's personal voicemail boxes.
Hello, Eric Carroll. You have no new messages.
Probably the most fulfilling thing that happened when I was preparing this latest version of the project for The Believer was I called this, the number was 877-FAX-OGRE, F-A-X-OGRE, and I reached a woman named Dawnice. Her name is spelled D-A-W-N-I-S-E, and I've had a couple conversations with her on the phone now, and she and I have now become email buddies, email pen pals. But she, it turns out that her phone number is 1-877-DAWNICE. It's her own name as a toll-free phone number. And I actually called her number about 5-6 times in a row because she introduced herself. She said, hello, this is Dawnice, but I couldn't tell what her name was because it's an unusual kind of name. So I called a few times in a row just to hear her automated pickup message, her voicemail, and hear what it said.
Hello, you have reached the offices of Dawnice Karen Enterprises. Please leave any message, and we'll be happy to get back with you just as soon as we can. Be blessed. Namaste.
So it's like this, she seemed like this kind person. I think a couple days passed, and I got a call back from Dawnice, and she called my number because, you know, she saw that, hey, she got something like 5-6 calls in a row one day from this number she didn't recognize. I didn't know that I was getting the call from Fax Ogre because it just doesn't show up that way, of course, on my cell phone. I picked up and she says, hello. And immediately, I knew that that was Dawnice. I knew that it was her. And she said, yeah, I got some calls from this number the other day and I was just returning the call. And I just decided to, you know, I told Dawnice exactly what the project was. I said, well, you know, my name's Brian. I am a writer, artist in San Francisco. And the reason I called your number is because it has the word ogre in it and it happens to spell Fax Ogre. And she said, oh no, you know, but she sort of understood it right away in a way that she was tickled by the idea of this. And we got around to talking about, I said, well, you know, why do you have this toll-free number? And she said, well, you know, I have this toll-free number that is my name. And she has it. She said, I got this toll-free number because I wanted to be able to receive calls from the universe. And I wanted to be able to receive calls that were just for me. And this is a call like that. And there was some other guy, you know, there's another guy who I called his number, I think, for the same reason. I called it, you know, 5-6 times in a row to make sure I get the information right on the automated recording. Now another guy calls me and he says, hey, I got several calls from this number. Who are you? And I said, well, my name's Brian. And he goes, well, why did you call? And I said, I called because, you know, your phone number has ogre in it. And he says, well, what do you need from me? And I said, I don't need anything from you. He was just not somebody, he was angry. He was upset. He didn't understand. I chose not to go. I answered every question he asked truthfully, but I mean, his immediate guess was, of course, what am I trying to sell him? Which, of course, is a fair question. And like, I think he was irked that he got calls and I didn't have a business purpose and possibly a business number that I was calling. So I don't at all fault that response, but it reveals something that's pretty obvious, where it just casts into relief something that should be pretty obvious, which is like, if a stranger calls you at your business number, I guess the expectation, I mean, it's obvious to the point of not even remarking on it maybe, but if a stranger calls you at your business number, they either want to buy something or want to sell something. And if it's not that they want to buy something or they want to sell something, then the appropriate response is anger. I don't know. Is that, that's an unwritten rule of America, is that if you call a business number and don't have a business question, then anger is an appropriate response because it's, is it wasting time?
You would typically know what you were interested in purchasing and then give us a call.
Okay, but I don't know what you sell, so I'm not sure what I might be interested in buying. So if you could just give me a few examples, maybe I'll think about buying one of them.
There are hundreds and hundreds of products. There's a Shark vacuum, Ninja Mega kitchen system. There's Micro Max shavers. Just whatever you were interested in purchasing.
What is a Shark vacuum?
It's a vacuum cleaner.
What are some of the good things about it?
Sir, when you're ready to give us, when you're ready to order, you know what you want. You give us a call back. You have a great night.
But it's a little bit of like, through 105 phone numbers, you kind of get a picture of America in its current state in some way. Let's call 1-877-DAD-OGRE.
Do you take Viagra? What if we could promise you the same results for less than $3 a pill? Our pill delivers the exact same results, and it comes with a no-questions-asked money-back guarantee. Want more? We'll give you 40 blue pills for $99 and add 4 more pills free. So stop paying for Viagra. Call us at 1-800-400-1499.
Let's see. I would like to now... Let's dial 1-888-FUN-OGRE.
The best way to get a hold of Brian's indirectory of toll-free ogres is by subscribing to The Believer. Not only will this get the magazine safely to your home each month, but it will also ensure the continued existence of The Believer. Subscriptions are the lifeblood of our project, and we rely and survive with your support. And so here is that special deal I alluded to earlier. If you go to BelieverMag.com, click on subscribe, around the time when the credit card is happening, you'll see a place to enter a coupon code, and that coupon code for you alone is the word anniversary spelled correctly, and then the subscription will be discounted to $40 for 9 issues a year. Those 9 issues include the celebrated music issue, which each year comes with a compilation of hand-picked music. There's the film issue, which arrives lashed to an actual piece of cinema. And there's the November-December art issue, which often also comes lashed to some sort of conceptual ogre or a poster or another kind of visual bonanza. If you hate e-commerce, you can call 415-642-5609 to subscribe. You can bother our managing editor, Andy Mudd. Ask for her by name. In summary, really good idea if you subscribe to The Believer. Essential, hilarious, razor-sharp writing every month from people like Nick Hornby, Jonathan Lethem, Zadie Smith, all of the finest users and writers and composers of the English language today. Essays, interviews, experimental ogre directories, all in one lavishly printed, totally unglossy, perfect-bound monthly treasure. Okay, that's done. We're done. This podcast was produced by me and Ross Simonini, engineered by Ross and JC Swatek at KCRW. Past and future episodes will be available at kcrw.com/believer. Our associate producer is Jenna Weiss-Berman. Many thanks to Harriet Ells, Jennifer Farrow, and everyone at KCRW in Los Angeles. Thanks also to Heidi Julevitz, Vendela Vita, Andy Mudd, Sheila Hetty, Carolina Vatslaviak, Dominic Luxford, and the rest of the staff of The Believer magazine, all of whom turned 10 years old today. Language assistance in this episode comes from Matthew Derby and Kevin Moffitt. Additional thanks to Janet Saidi, Scott Pham, and the staff of KBIA in Columbia. Our interns are Ted Hart and Cooper Middlehauser. Email things to organist@believermag.com. Leave a luminous voicemail at 573-238-8453. Music in this episode was selected by Devendra Banhart. Stream a playlist of his selections at kcrw.com/believer. We'll be back next month with another emotionally affecting episode of The Organist. Until then, you can come see us at our 10-year anniversary parties. Nick Hornby, Sheila Hetty, Ed Park, Dawn of Midi, and Amanda Filipacki will be at Le Poisson Rouge in New York on March 7th. Gary Lutz, Margot Jefferson, Joanna Furman, and Alan Gilbert will be at the Greenlight Bookstore in Brooklyn, New York, March 25th. I will be there. Who cares? It's all about Gary Lutz. More info is, as ever, at kcrw.com/believer. Looking forward to seeing you, hearing from you, being in love with you for the rest of our lives.
You can't get old too much. People make you talk when all you want to do is run away.
Sometimes
feeling out of touch. No one talks to me. No one wants to hear what I say.
Sometimes
we always seem to laugh. It proves that we're alright. It proves that we can really have fun.
Sometimes
we don't even talk. And it seems to me we're not happy, but at least we're young. Don't wanna fight, but what we're doing tonight.